Another piece of news is overnight, you got rid of the chairman of the Competition and Markets Authority, and people conceived that as being a pro-growth, pro-deregulation, because one of the things about Trump is, yes, business people, people at Davos, are scared of his trade wars, but they do like the pro-growth, deregulatory side of Trump. Is this a sign of more things to come in terms of regulation?
Well, growth is the number one mission of this new Labour government. 6 months in, we are building the foundations to deliver that strong growth that has eluded the UK for far too long, more than a decade of very slow, sluggish economic growth. And we want our regulators to be part of that growth mission. Now, of course, the regulators are independent, and the chair of the CMA decided to step down. But he recognised that this government have got a different strategic approach when it comes to regulation. And he recognised that it was time for him to move on and make way for somebody who does share the mission and the strategic direction that this government are taking. So, look, we wrote, myself, Johnny, the Prime Minister, to all of the regulators. There's more than 100 regulators in the UK. We've written to all of them and said, what can you do to reorientate your organisation to regulate not just for risk, and of course regulating for risk is important, but regulating for growth. I've done it with the financial services regulators. We've now done it with all of the regulators. And I've got to say, the responses we've had, a lot of them have been incredibly positive about things that they can do.
Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you, Radha. It's fantastic to be here at the Siemens Health and Ears at this amazing facility. Today, I want to talk about economic growth, why it matters, how we achieve it, and what we are going to do to go further and faster to deliver it. Before we came into office, the Prime Minister and I have said loud and clear, economic growth is the number one mission of this government. Without growth, we cannot cut hospital waiting lists or put more police on the streets. Without growth, we cannot meet our climate goals or give the next generation the opportunities that they need to thrive. But most of all, without economic growth, we cannot improve the living standards of ordinary working people. Because growth isn't simply about lines on a graph. It's about the pounds in people's pockets, the vibrancy of our high streets, and the thriving businesses that create wealth, jobs, and new opportunities for us, for our children and grandchildren. We will have succeeded in our mission when working people are better off. I know that the cost of living crisis is still very real for many families across Britain. The sky-high inflation and interest rates of the past few years have left a deep mark, with too many people still making sacrifices to pay the bills and to pay their mortgages. But we have begun to turn things around. Everything I see as I travel around the country gives me more belief in Britain and more optimism about our future. Because we as a country have huge potential. A country of strong communities with small and local businesses at their heart. We are at the forefront of some of the most exciting developments in the world, like artificial intelligence and life sciences, with great companies like DeepMind, AstraZeneca, Rolls-Royce, and of course Siemens, delivering jobs and investment across Britain. We have fundamental strengths in our history, in our language, and in our legal system to compete in a global economy. But for too long, that potential has been held back. For too long, we have accepted low expectations and accepted decline. We no longer have to do that. We can do so much better. Low growth is not our destiny. But growth will not come without a fight, without a government willing to take the right decisions now to change our country's future for the better. That's what our plan for change is all about. That is what drives me as Chancellor. In my Mays lecture in March last year, I set out my approach to achieving economic growth and identified the fundamental barriers to realising our full potential. The productive capacity of the UK economy has become far too weak. Productivity, the driver of living standards, has grown more slowly here than in countries like Germany or the US. The supply side of our economy has suffered due to chronic underinvestment and stifling and unpredictable regulation, not helped by the shocks that we have faced in recent years. For too long, politicians have lacked the courage or the strength to confront these challenges. When presented with a choice, they have not prioritised growth. Instead, they have accepted the status quo. And they have been the barrier, not the enablers, of change. At the election, people voted for a whole new approach. And that is what I am determined to deliver. The strategy that I have consistently set out is to grow the supply side of our economy, recognising that first and foremost, it is businesses, investors and entrepreneurs who drive economic growth. A government that systematically removes barriers that they face one by one and has their back is the solution to our challenges. This strategy has three elements. First, stability. Stability in our politics, our public finances and our economy. The basic condition for secure economic growth. Second, reform. Reform which makes it easier for businesses to trade, to raise finance, and to build. And third, investment, the lifeblood of economic growth. Let me explain each of those in turn. Stability. The first line of our manifesto was a promise to bring stability back to our public finances. It is the rock upon which everything else is built, and it is an essential foundation in our plan for change. Because economic stability is the precondition for economic growth. That's why the first piece of legislation that we passed as a government was the Budget Responsibility Act. So that never again can we see our independent forecaster sidelined, and never again will we see a repeat of the Liz Truss mini-budget, which sent borrowing costs and mortgage rates spiralling for families and for businesses. At my first budget in October, it was my duty as Chancellor to fix the foundations of our economy and repair the public finances that we inherited, to restore stability and create the conditions for growth and investment. I set out new fiscal rules, which are non-negotiable and will always be met. We began to rebuild our NHS and our schools, the start of a programme of public service reform. I capped the rate of corporation tax, and I extended our generous capital allowances for the duration of this Parliament, as the CBI and the BCC have called for. And I protected working people after a cost of living crisis by freezing fuel duty with no increases in their national insurance, income tax or VAT. But taking the right decisions and the responsible decisions does not always mean taking the easy decisions. The increase in employers' national insurance contributions has consequences on business and beyond. I said that up front in my budget speech. I accept that there are costs to responsibility. But the costs of irresponsibility would have been far higher. Those who oppose my budget know that too. That is why, since October, I've seen no alternative put forward by the opposition parties. No alternative to deal with the challenges that we face. No alternative to restoring economic stability. And therefore, no plan for driving economic growth. Alongside stability, we need to drive forward the reform which makes investment more likely. By removing the constraints on the supply side of our economy, making it easier for businesses to trade, to raise finance, and to build. Let me first address our approach to trade. We stand at a moment of global change. In that context, we should be guided by one clear principle above all: to act in the national interest, for our economy, for our businesses, and for the British people. That means building on our special relationship with the United States under President Trump. The Prime Minister discussed the vital importance of growth with the President last weekend, and I look forward to working with the new Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, to deepen our economic relationship in the months and years ahead. Acting in our national interest also means resetting our relationship with the EU, our nearest and our largest trading partner, to drive growth and support business. We are pragmatic about the challenges that we have inherited from the last government's failed Brexit deal. But we are also ambitious in our goals. Unlike the Conservative Party, whose policy was not to engage with the European Union at all, we will prioritise proposals that are consistent with our manifesto commitments and which contribute to British growth and British prosperity, because that is what the national interest demands. Our approach to trade also means building stronger relationships with fast-growing economies all around the world. That is why I led a delegation to China for the first economic and financial dialogue since 2019, alongside world-leading financial services businesses, including HSBC, Standard Chartered, and Schroders, unlocking £600 million of tangible benefits for the UK economy. And I am pleased to confirm that the Business and Trade Secretary will shortly visit India to restart talks on the free trade agreement and bilateral investment treaty that the last government failed to deliver. Our businesses can only realise these opportunities if they can recruit the skilled staff that they need. So we are reforming our employment system to create a national jobs and career service. We have created Skills England to meet the skills of the next decade in sectors like construction and engineering. And we will deliver fundamental reform of our welfare system. That includes looking at areas that have been ducked for too long, like the rising cost of health and disability benefits. And the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions will set out our plans to address this ahead of the spring statement. Next, the immigration white paper. That will bring forward concrete proposals to bring the overall levels of net migration down. But we know that the UK is in an international competition for talent in vital growth sectors. That is why last week I set out plans for attracting global talent to Britain. We will look at the visa routes for very highly skilled people, so the best people in the world choose the UK to live, work and create wealth, bringing jobs and investment to Britain. To help businesses access the finance and support they need to grow, we have delivered significant reforms to provide greater flexibility for firms and founders to raise finance on UK capital markets by rewriting our listing rules. In my Mansion House speech, I announced a series of reforms to our pension system, including the creation of larger consolidated funds, which have much greater capacity to invest in high-growth British companies at the scale that we need them to. The consultation on these reforms is already complete, and the final report will be published in the spring. Yesterday, we confirmed that we have plans to go further, whilst always protecting the important role that pension funds play in the gilt market. We will introduce new flexibilities for well-funded defined benefit schemes to release surplus funds where it is safe to do so, generating even more investment into some of our fastest growing industries. I know too that businesses are held back by a complex and unpredictable regulatory system, and that is a drag on investment and innovation. We have already provided new growth-focused remits to our financial service regulators We have announced a new interim chair of the Competition and Markets Authority. And we have established the Regulatory Innovation Office with an initial focus on synthetic biology, space, AI, and connected and autonomous vehicles. But we need to go further and we need to go faster. So earlier this month, I met the heads of some of our largest regulators. They have already provided a range of options to drive growth in their sectors and proposals for how they can be more agile and responsive to businesses. And we will publish that final action plan in March to make regulation work much better for our economy. To get Britain building again, we have delivered the most significant reforms to our planning system in a generation. I have been genuinely shocked about how slow our planning system is, by how long it takes things to get things done. Take the decision to build a solar farm in Cambridgeshire, a decision that the Energy Secretary took only a few weeks into the job in July, but which had first come to government's attention in 2021. It's ridiculous. The Deputy Prime Minister now has already driven significant progress across government in addressing these issues. My colleagues have determined 30 major planning decisions in just 6 months, including for airports, data centres and major housing developments. We have significantly raised housing targets across the country and made them mandatory so that we can build 1.5 million homes in this Parliament. We have reformed decades-old green belt policies, making it easier to build on the grey belt land around our major cities. And we have opened up our planning system to build new infrastructure, like onshore wind farms or data centres driving the AI revolution. Having listened closely to calls from business groups, like the Institute of Directors and businesses across our economy, about the need to speed up infrastructure delivery, including MACE, Skanska and Arup, who are here today, and members of our British Infrastructure Task Force, like Lloyds, BlackRock and Phoenix, we have now set out plans to go even further. Last week, we confirmed our priorities for the Planning and Infrastructure Bill to rapidly streamline the process for determining applications, to make the consultation process far less burdensome, and to fundamentally reform our approach to environmental regulation. The problems in our economy, the lack of bold reform that we have seen over decades, can be summed up by a £100 million bat tunnel built for HS2. The type of decision that has made delivering major infrastructure in our country far too expensive and far too slow. So we are reducing the environmental requirements placed on developers when they pay into a nature restoration fund that we have created, so they can focus on getting things built and stop worrying about the bats and the newts. And to build our new infrastructure, like nuclear power plants, train lines and wind farms more quickly, we are changing the rules to stop blockers getting in the way of development through excessive use of judicial review. This bill, the Planning and Infrastructure Bill, is a priority for this government. It will be introduced in the spring, and we will work tirelessly in Parliament to ensure its smooth, speedy, and rapid delivery. By providing a foundation of economic stability, and by delivering the reforms needed to make it easier for businesses to succeed and grow, we will create the right conditions to increase investment in our economy, the final key element of our strategy. Investment and innovation go hand in hand. I want to see the sounds and the sights of the future arriving, delivered by amazing businesses like Wave and Oxford Nanopore. They are the future, and Britain should be the best place in the world to be an entrepreneur. That is why we protected funding for research and development, and it is why one of the first decisions that I made as Chancellor was to extend the Enterprise Investment Scheme and the Venture Capital Trust schemes for a further 10 years to get more investment into new companies, driving their innovation and growth. I am determined to make Britain the best place in the world to invest. That was my message in Davos last week. That ambition demands action. The International Investment Summit that we hosted in October delivered £63 billion of investment right across our country. From Iberdrola, doubling its investment in clean energy in places like Suffolk. Blackstone investing £10 billion in a data centre in Northumberland. And Erin Holdings investing £1 billion in advanced manufacturing in North Wales. While the lifeblood of growth is business investment, a strategic state has a crucial role to play. That is why we established the National Wealth Fund, to create that partnership between business, private investors and government to invest in the industries of the future, like clean energy. Today I can announce two further investments by the National Wealth Fund. First, a £65 million investment for Connected Curb to expand their electric vehicle charging network across the UK. And second, a £28 million equity investment in Cornish Metals, providing the raw materials to be used in solar panels, wind turbines and electric vehicles, supporting growth and jobs in the southwest of England. There is no trade-off between economic growth and net zero. Quite the opposite. Net zero is the industrial opportunity of the 21st century, and Britain must lead the way. That is why we will publish a refreshed carbon budget delivery plan later this year, which alongside the spending review will set out our plans to deliver carbon budget 6. Today, I can also announce that we are removing barriers to deliver 16 gigawatts of offshore wind by designating new marine protected areas to enable the development of this technology in areas like East Anglia and Yorkshire, crowding in up to £30 billion of investment in homegrown clean power. And there's more. Our industrial and manufacturing base, represented brilliantly by Make UK, have been banging their heads against the wall for years at the lack of a proper industrial strategy from government. That is why we have launched our modern industrial strategy to drive investment into the industries that will define our success in the years ahead. We have already provided funding to unlock investment in sectors like aerospace, automotives and life sciences. And we have set out reforms to boost financial services, the AI sector, and our brilliant creative industries. We are not wasting any time, and we will move forward with the next steps of the industrial strategy ahead of its publication in the spring. We will work with the private sector to deliver the infrastructure that our country desperately needs. This includes the Lower Thames Crossing, which will improve connectivity at Dover, Felixstowe and Harwich, alleviating severe congestion as goods destined to export come from the north and the Midlands and across the country to markets overseas. To drive growth and to deliver value for money for taxpayers, we are exploring options to privately finance this important project. And we have changed course on public investment too, with a new investment rule to ensure that we don't just count the costs of investment, we count the benefits too. We are now investing 2.6% of GDP on average over the next 5 years, compared to 1.9% planned by the previous government, delivering an additional £100 billion of growth-enhancing capital spending, which catalyses private sector investment in more housing, better transport links, and clean energy. These are significant steps in just 6 months, and we are seeing some encouraging signs in the British economy. The IMF have upgraded our growth prospects for 2025. The only G7 country outside the US to see this happen. This gives us the fastest growth of any major European economy this year. And a global survey of CEOs by PwC has shown that Britain is now the second most attractive country in the world for businesses looking to invest. The first time that the UK has been in that position for 28 years. This is all welcome news, but there is still more that we can and we will do. I am not satisfied with the position that we are in. While we have huge amounts of potential, the structural problems in our economy run deep. And the low growth of the last 14 years cannot just be turned around overnight. This has to be our focus for the duration of the Parliament, because the situation demands us to do more. And today I will go further and faster in kick-starting economic growth. Our mission to grow the economy is about raising living standards in every single part of the United Kingdom. Manchester is home to the UK's fastest growing tech sector. Leeds is one of the largest financial services centres outside of London. These great northern cities have so much potential and promise, which our brilliant Metro Mayors, Andy Burnham and Tracy Brabin, are working hard to realise, just like our other Metro Mayors are doing to deliver new opportunities in their areas. And there is so much more that government can do to support our city regions. To achieve this requires greater focus on two key areas, infrastructure and investment. If we can improve connectivity between towns and cities across the north of England, we can unlock their true growth potential by making it easier for people to live, travel and work across the area. At the budget, I set out funding for the Transpennine Route upgrade, a multi-billion pound programme of improvements that will connect towns and cities from Manchester to York via Stalybridge, Bridge, Leeds and Huddersfield. We are delivering railway schemes to improve journeys for people across the north, including upgrades at Bradford Forster Square and by electrifying the Wigan to Bolton line. We are committed to supporting the delivery of a new mass transport system in West Yorkshire. And in spring, we will publish the spending review and a 10-year infrastructure strategy, which will set out further detail of our plans for infrastructure investment right across the UK. New transport infrastructure can also act as a catalyst for new housing. We have already seen the benefits that unlocking untapped land around stations can deliver in places like Stockport, where joint work spearheaded by Andy Burnham and council leaders has delivered new housing and wider commercial opportunities. We will introduce a new approach to planning decisions on land around stations, changing the default answer to yes. We are working with the devolved governments to ensure the benefits of growth can be felt across Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, including by partnering with them on the industrial strategy to support their considerable sectoral strengths. And in December, I met with Metro Mayors from across England. They told me that more opportunities for investment are vital if their local economies are to grow in the years ahead. We are listening closely to them. As the Metro Mayor of Liverpool, Steve Rotherham, has called for, we will review the Green Book and how it is being used to provide objective, transparent advice on public investment across the country, including outside London and the South East. This means that investment in all regions is given a fair hearing by the Treasury that I lead. The Office for Investment is going to be working hand in hand with local areas to develop a commercially attractive pipeline of investment opportunities for a global audience, starting with the Liverpool City Region and the North East Combined Authority, led by Kim McGuinness. The National Wealth Fund is establishing strategic partnerships to provide deeper, more focused support for city regions, starting in Glasgow, West Yorkshire, the West Midlands, and Greater Manchester. We are supporting key investment opportunities across the UK. The government is also backing Andy Burnham's plans for the redevelopment of Old Trafford, which promises to create new housing and commercial development around a new stadium to drive regeneration and growth in the area. We are moving forward with the Wrexham and Flintshire Investment Zone, focusing on the area's strengths in advanced manufacturing, backed by major businesses like Airbus and JCB, to leverage £1 billion of private investment in the next 10 years, creating up to 6,000 jobs. The last government stood by as Doncaster Sheffield Airport was closed by its owner, despite the overwhelming support for it to stay open. It now sits idle, despite the potential to drive jobs and growth across the north. So I can announce today that we will work with Doncaster Council and the Mayor of South Yorkshire, Oliver Coppard, to support their efforts to recreate South Yorkshire Airport City as a thriving regional airport. And finally, I am pleased to announce a partnership between Prologis and Manchester Airport Group in the East Midlands, where the Metro Mayor, Claire Ward, is doing an excellent job growing the local economy there. Prologis and MAG will work together to build a new advanced manufacturing and logistics park at East Midlands Airport, unlocking up to £1 billion of investment and 2,000 jobs at the site. A major investment from a global business into our country, representing a huge vote of confidence in the East Midlands and in the UK. This is just the start of our work to get more investment into every nation and region of Britain. Next, I want to set out further detail for plans for the area we are in today. Oxford and Cambridge offer huge potential for our nation's growth prospects. Only 66 miles apart, these cities are home to two of the best universities in the world, and the area is a hub for globally renowned science and technology firms. This area has the potential to be Europe's Silicon Valley. To make that a reality, we need a systematic approach to attract businesses to come here and to grow here. At the moment, it takes 2.5 hours to travel between Oxford and Cambridge by train. There is no way to commute directly by rail from places like Bedford and Milton Keynes to Cambridge. And there is a lack of affordable housing right across the region. In other words, the demand is there, but there are far too many supply-side constraints on economic growth here. We are going to fix that. The Oxcam ARC was initially launched in 2003, over 20 years ago. But the project was then dropped by the previous government in 2021. We are not prepared to miss out on the opportunities any longer. So working with the Deputy Prime Minister, who is already driving forward vital work in the region, we are going further and faster to unlock the potential of the Oxford-Cambridge growth corridor. First, we are funding the transport links needed to make the Oxford-Cambridge growth corridor a success, including East-West Rail, with new services between Oxford and Milton Keynes starting this year, and road upgrades to reduce journey times between Milton Keynes and Cambridge. East-West Rail will also support vibrant new and expanded communities along the route. We have already received proposals for new towns along the new railway, with 18 submissions for sizeable new developments. At Thamesford, the nexus of the East Coast Main Line, the A1 and East-West Rail, we will move quicker to deliver a mainline station, meaning journey times to London of under an hour and to Cambridge in under 30 minutes when East-West Rail is operational. Second, we are ensuring that the area has the right infrastructure and public services in place to support the growth corridor as it expands. a new Cambridge Cancer Research Hospital is being prioritised for investment as part of wave one of the new hospital programme. Water infrastructure has also been a major hindrance to development in the region. We have now agreed water resources management plans, unlocking £7.9 billion of investment in the next 5 years, including plans for the new Fens Reservoir serving Cambridge and the South East Strategic Reservoir near Oxford. And I can confirm today that the Environment Agency have now lifted their objections to new development in Cambridge following this government's intervention to address water scarcity, which means 4,500 additional homes, new schools, new office, retail and laboratory space can be built. Third, I am delighted that Cambridge University have come forward with plans for a new flagship innovation hub at the centre of Cambridge to attract global investment and foster a community that catalyses innovation, as other cities around the world like Boston and Paris have done. Just yesterday, Moderna completed the build for their new vaccine production and R&D site in Harwell, right here in Oxfordshire, alongside a commitment to invest a further £1 billion in the UK. And we are creating a new AI growth zone in Culham to speed up planning approvals for the rapid build-out of data centres. And finally, to take this project forward at real pace and catalyse private sector investment into the region, I am pleased to announce that the Deputy Prime Minister and I have asked Lord Patrick Vallance to be the champion for the Oxford-Cambridge Growth Corridor. Lord Vallance has extensive experience across the sciences, academia and government. He will work with local leaders and with the Housing and Planning Minister to deliver this exciting project, including with Peter Freeman, who is already doing excellent work in Cambridge, and a new growth commission for Oxford, which will help to accelerate growth in the city and its surrounding area. This is the government's modern industrial strategy in action, with central government, local leaders and businesses working together. The Oxford-Cambridge growth corridor could add up to £78 billion to the UK economy by 2035, driving investment, innovation and economic growth. Finally, I come to the decision that perhaps more than any other has been delayed, has been avoided, has been ducked. The question of whether to give Heathrow, our only hub airport, a third runway, has run on for decades. The last full-length runway in Britain was built in the 1940s. No progress in 80 years. Why is this so damaging? It's because Heathrow is at the heart of the UK's openness as a country. It connects us to emerging markets all over the world, opening up new opportunities for growth. Around three quarters of all long-haul flights in the UK go from Heathrow. Over 60% of UK air freight comes through Heathrow. And about 15 million business travellers used Heathrow in 2023. But for decades, its growth has been constrained. Successive studies have shown that this really matters for our economy. According to the most recent study from Frontier Economics, a third runway could increase potential GDP by 0.43% by 2050. Over half, 60% of that boost, would go to areas outside of London and the South East, increasing trade opportunities for products like Scotch whisky and Scottish salmon, already two of the biggest British exports out of Heathrow. And a third runway could create over 100,000 jobs. For international investors, persistent delays have cast doubt about our seriousness towards improving our economic prospects. Business groups like the CBI, the Federation of Small Businesses, and the Chambers of Commerce right across the UK, as well as trade unions like GMB and Unite, are clear. A third runway is badly needed. In 2018, the previous government steered its airport's national policy statement through Parliament. But no action was taken. It simply sat on the shelf. We are taking a totally different approach to airport expansion. This government has already given its support to expansion at City Airport and at Stansted. And there are two live decisions on Luton and Gatwick which will be made by the Transport Secretary shortly. But as our only hub airport, Heathrow is in a unique position, and we cannot duck the decision any longer. I have always been clear that a third runway at Heathrow would unlock further growth, boost investment, increase exports, and make the UK more open and more connected. And now the case is stronger than ever, because our reforms to the economy, like speeding up the planning system and our plans to modernise UK airspace, means the delivery of this project is now set up for success. So I can confirm today that this government supports a third runway at Heathrow and is inviting proposals to be brought forward by the summer. We will then take forward a full assessment through the Airport National Policy Statement. This will ensure that the project is value for money, and our clear expectation is that any associated surface transport costs will be financed through private funding. And it will ensure that a third runway is delivered in line with our legal, environmental and climate objectives. Heathrow themselves are clear that their proposal for expansion will meet strict rules on noise, air quality and carbon emissions. And we are already making great strides in transitioning to cleaner and greener aviation. Sustainable aviation fuel reduces CO2 emissions compared to fossil fuel by around 70%. At the start of this month, the Sustainable Aviation Fuel Mandate became law. And today I can announce that we are investing £63 million into the Advanced Fuels Fund over the next year. And we have today set out the details of how we will deliver a revenue certainty mechanism to encourage investment into this growing industry. These measures will encourage more investors to back production in the UK, bringing good, high-skilled jobs to areas like Teesside, demonstrating that investment in the right technology can help us deliver both our growth and our clean energy mission. Now is the time to grasp the huge opportunity in front of us. By backing a third runway at Heathrow, we can make Britain the world's best connected place to do business. That is what it takes to make decisions in the national interest. And that is what I mean by going further and faster to kickstart economic growth. The work of change has begun. We have already made great progress, but I am not satisfied, and I know that there is more to be done. We must go further and faster if we are to build a brighter future. And the prize on offer if we do this is immense. The next generation with more opportunities than the last. An engineer in Teesside, working in some of the most exciting industries of the future, from carbon capture to sustainable aviation fuel. A scientist in Milton Keynes or Bedford commuting to Oxford or Cambridge, working in our life sciences industry to solve some of the most important medical challenges in the world. A small business owner in Scotland knowing that they can expand and export to new markets right across the world. Wealth created and wealth shared in every part of Britain. This is a government on the side of working people, taking the right decisions to secure their future, to secure our future, stepping up to the challenges that we face, ending the era of low expectations, putting Britain on a different path, delivering for the British people, and I am determined, this government is determined, to do just that. Thank you. Thank you. I'll now take a number of questions. I'll start with Chris Mason from the BBC.
Thank you, Chancellor. Chris Mason, BBC News. The scars in our economy run deep. We've had the pandemic, we've had conflict, we've had the financial crisis, as I say, and also the colossal shift of economic heft towards China and the East. What do you say to those who might say, is this anywhere near enough? When will we see cranes in the sky? And what happens if it doesn't work? Thank you.
Well, we need to go further and faster. And the speech and the announcements that I've set out today, whether it is the regional investment in places like Manchester or Leeds or Teesside, whether it is the Oxcam Arc growth corridor, which could be Europe's Silicon Valley, or indeed making Britain better connected with the third runway at Heathrow, shows that this is a government with ambition that is getting on and delivering. But one of the reasons why we need to expand Heathrow is that there are emerging markets and new cities around the world that we aren't connected to because there aren't the slots at Heathrow or indeed any other airport to fly to. And similarly, the opportunities to export around the world only grow when other countries around the world grow their economies. And yet we don't have the opportunities to export there because we are constrained. Our supply side capacity is constrained because there hasn't been enough investment in our ports and our airports for too long. So we are turning that around. We are systematically, one by one, removing the barriers that have held back our growth performance for too long. Because you take those shocks that you mentioned. Well, those shocks have affected countries all around the world. But every time one of them comes along, it seems to affect the UK more. And the impact of it lasts longer. So we've got to build a more secure and a resilient economy. And these investments, and cracking on with them, that's why it's different this time. Because we're reforming the planning system. The Planning and Infrastructure Bill will be a priority for this government because it means that projects like the expansion of Heathrow, like East-West Rail, like the new towns that we want to build, can happen at pace rather than taking decades, which I'm afraid has been our experience as a country for far too long. Next question from Ed Conway at Sky.
Thank you, Chancellor. Lots of exciting plans today. By definition, though, some of them will take quite a long time to actually come to fruition, you know, whether it's reservoirs or runways. So I just wonder, you know, can you give us a sense of what are we looking to judge success here? You know, how, what kind of metrics can we work out whether we're succeeding? Is it GDP? Is it GDP per capita? You had this plan to have the fastest growing economy in the G7. Does that still exist, or is it just living standards, which are important but not the same?
Well, I agree with you, Ed, that these are exciting plans, and these are plans that are going to take our country forward. We said when we set out the plan for change that we want living standards for working people to improve. That's what we want people to see and experience and feel in their own pockets by the time that this Parliament comes to an end. And that's why we are trying to crack on with things. There's no point in announcing a third runway at Heathrow if you've got the same planning system that we have now, because it will take decades and people won't feel the benefit. There's no point in saying we're going to build 1.5 million homes. It's just talk unless you reform the planning system. So that's why, alongside the big announcements we're making today, we are making changes so we can actually get on and deliver these projects, not just talk about them. Next question from Andy Bell at Channel 5.
Thank you very much. Andy Bell, Channel 5 News. Chancellor, as you know, there are a lot of people in business who say the biggest barrier to growth are the taxes that you put on business at the budget. So can you offer the possibility of any tweaks to what you levied in terms of taxes on business back in your budget? And can you rule out any further taxation on business in this Parliament?
Well, I explained in my speech today why I had to make the decisions that I made. And, you know, from the Conservatives, they want the extra money for public services, but they oppose any of the tax increases to fund it. They say they want the extra infrastructure, but they don't support the changes to the planning system to get things built. So I hear criticism of what we're doing, haven't heard any serious alternative. And when I became Chancellor, the first thing that I had to do was restore stability to our public finances. We know what happens when governments lose control of the public finances. We've experienced it in the last few years. And what happens is mortgage rates and interest rates go through the roof, costing families and business dearly. I will never play fast and loose with the public finances because it is ordinary people who pay the price. So I had to make some difficult decisions, but they were the right decisions in our national interest. And you can build no plan for growth that is not built on a rock of stability. We've returned stability to the economy, and that is why we can now grow it with confidence. But just listen to what businesses have said about our plans today. The CBI says that they are smart. There's other business people in this room who are backing the plans that we are setting out today. They can see that this is a government that is getting on with things, that is removing the barriers that have held back infrastructure investment and investment by businesses for far too long, and we are changing that. I'm not going to write 5 years' worth of budgets in the first 6 months of office, but that was a once-in-a-generation budget to fix the inheritance and to draw a line under the economic and fiscal mismanagement of the Conservatives. Next question from Chris Hope at GB News.
Chris Hope, GB News, Chancellor. But will you commit now to cutting net migration, even if it damages economic growth, that trade-off there? And just quickly, millions are sending in their tax returns this week to HMRC. You're in charge of it. Will you publish your tax return?
So we will reduce net migration, but taking back control means having more of a say of who comes into this country. And that's why I announced in Davos last week that we're looking at visa routes for some of the most highly skilled and talented people, because I want them to see what I see in Britain, which is the best place in the world to start and grow a business. So we want to attract that talent, but absolutely, we've made that commitment to bring net migration down. Well, thank you for the reminder to everybody to get their tax returns. We will use that money wisely to invest in infrastructure and grow our economy. Chancellors and Prime Ministers haven't published their tax returns in the past, and I don't have any plans to do so. The next question is from Harriet Lyne at the Daily Mail.
Thanks, Chancellor. Harriet Lyne, Daily Mail. Your own government thinks that the workers' rights package will cost the economy £5 billion. If you're serious about growth, why don't you just junk that?
Well, for ordinary working people to have security over the number of hours they are working, what their wages are going to be from week to week, that they're not at the whim of their employer and things like fire and rehire, gives ordinary working people the confidence to go out and spend in the economy. There's loads of evidence that a secure workforce is a more confident, more productive workforce, and also more confident to spend in the economy. So I believe that a strong package of workers' rights and protections for people at work go hand in hand with a strong economy. But throughout the whole process of the Employment Rights Bill, Angela Rayner and Johnny Reynolds have worked closely with business to understand their concerns on things like the importance of having probation periods, for example, and the flexibility to take on workers during busy times, whether that's the holiday or Christmas. And the bill that we take through Parliament will reflect those concerns so that we get the balance right, supporting working people and supporting businesses. The next question is from Heather Stewart at The Guardian.
Hi, Chancellor. Heather Stewart from The Guardian. You've struck a very optimistic tone today. You've talked about the UK's upbeat economic prospects. Feels quite different to the tone you struck in your early months in power when you were really quite gloomy about the legacy that you'd been left and the state of the economy. Prime Minister even called a press conference to tell us that we were in an economic and a social black hole. We got almost zero growth in the second half of 2024. I wonder if you regret that gloomy tone, and do you think that you and the Prime Minister talked down the economy in the back half of last year?
Well, the truth is, I did face a real challenge when I became Chancellor with a £22 billion black hole, not for some year in the future, but in the financial year we were in. And that required a number of difficult decisions on spending, on welfare and taxation. But I didn't shy away from those decisions, because if I had have tried to sweep them under the carpet, then we'd be here at this event today where businesses would know that the public finances didn't add up and know that I'd have to come back with more tax increases. And the questions would be, well, you know, you've still got this black hole in the public finances, so how are you going to fill them? We have now drawn a line under that economic mismanagement. The decisions weren't easy. I recognise that they have consequences, but the consequences of doing doing nothing and allowing our public finances to go unchecked would have been even greater. Returning stability to the economy, which has allowed the Bank of England to cut interest rates twice since this government came to office. Inflation now much closer anchored to 2%, now standing at 2.5%. Wages rising at twice the rate of inflation shows that some of that stability that we were lacking for so many years under the Conservatives has returned to the economy. But I am upbeat and optimistic about our country's prospects. You know, who wouldn't be being here at Siemens today? Who wouldn't be seeing what Rolls-Royce are doing in Derby, seeing what Hitachi are doing in Newton Aycliffe, seeing what Oxford Nanopore do just down the road? We have amazing companies in this country doing fantastic things, but the truth is we don't see that in the productivity and the GDP numbers. So we've got to turbocharge our economy. We've got to go further and faster in delivering the stability, the reform and the investment that is required to turn around our economic performance. I'll take the next question from Daniel Martin from The Telegraph.
Hello, Chancellor. If the economy continues to underperform and you don't meet your fiscal rules, can you rule out taking tax and spending measures on March the 26th?
You need to have a bit of Ed Conway's optimism about our exciting plans. Look, the OBR will be doing a report on March the 26th, an updated economic and fiscal report. It's still 2 months until that happens. Of course, they take into account a whole range of factors, and I look forward to seeing their forecast. I've been really clear about the fiscal rules. They are non-negotiable. They are what give stability to our economy. But we're still 2 months off, and a lot of things happen in that time, so I'm not going to give a running commentary on the March the 26th forecast, Daniel. The next question from Phil Aldrick at the, Bloomberg.
Thanks, Chancellor. You've set out a remarkable array of supply-side reforms, which are going to potentially have quite big effects over the long term, but in the short term, we've got the next rise coming up in April, which is a drag on growth potentially from the point of view of businesses. Are you doing anything in the short term to address these growth-depressing facets?
Well, the whole point about the reforms we're making are about enabling people to do things more quickly. So the regulatory reforms that we're making to put growth in the remit of our regulators, the planning reforms to make it easier to build things. And I've said to Heathrow, I want them to come forward with plans by the summer, and we want to have a development consent order come forward by the end of this Parliament, and we hope to be able to grant it in this Parliament. So we're not waiting for, you know, years into the future. We want to do things now to turn around the performance, and we want to give businesses and investors confidence that this is a country to start doing things, to start making things in again, because we are reforming how our economy works to make it easier for them to build the energy infrastructure, the transport infrastructure, the housing infrastructure and the data centres that we need. And a combination of our regulatory reforms and our planning reforms mean that we don't have to wait for decades into the future. We can crack on and do those things now. I've got a bit of extra time, so I'll take a few more questions. Lady there on the side.
Hi, thanks, Chancellor. Jessica Frankies from City AM. We've heard from regulators who are concerned about this deregulatory drive and say the optics are bad for international investment. Do you think regulators are on board with your plans? And do you think intervening in independent regulation is good for Britain?
Well, it's up to the government to set the framework, but I think that businesses probably know what is best for international investment and into the UK. And what businesses, big and small, say to me all the time, that a combination of the huge array of regulations, the number of consultees that they have to consult, the judicial review process, but also the conflicting regulations and rules that you have from different regulators over the same entity or the same investment just creates confusion. And there's a lack of predictability in our regulators, which is bad for business and bad for our economy. So I won't apologise for wanting to reform how regulation works in Britain. If we're going to grow the economy, we need to reform the regulators too. They need to be part of this growth mission. I've been really pleased by many of the replies that we've had from the regulators, and I look forward to working with them to ensure that, yes, we have independent regulation, but that those independent regulators also focus on growth, because it's the number one mission of this government and we've got a mandate to deliver it. Take a question from the lady there.
Thank you, Chancellor. Sophie Huskisson from The Mirror. The inquiry into the Grenfell Tower fire found deregulation contributed to the 2017 tragedy. Are you worried that safety could be put at risk if you rip up planning rules and reduce regulation? Thank you.
Well, the Prime Minister and the Deputy Prime Minister have both been to Grenfell and have made commitments to the families there to learn the lessons from what happened. So, of course, we've got to get the balance right on regulation, but we've made commitments to the families that have suffered because of what happened at Grenfell, and we will not renege on those commitments. I'll just take one last question from the lady behind you.
Hi, Natasha Clark from LBC. Thanks so much, Chancellor. Just in the last week, we've had quite a lot of businesses warn about job losses. 10,000 retail jobs at threat. Sainsbury's cutting 3,000 jobs. You're going for growth, but we are seeing quite a lot of businesses that are really, really worried about their future. Is this an encouraging sign for the British economy, or are you gaslighting British businesses? Thank you.
Well, businesses will always make decisions about the number of staff they need to meet demand. But look at the things that we've set out today. A third runway at Heathrow could create 100,000 jobs. The Prologis investment at East Midlands Airport could create 2,000 jobs. The investment in the Wrexham and Flintshire investment zone could create 6,000 jobs. So these are investments that are good for jobs, are good for wealth creation, investment in the UK, and good ultimately for living standards. Because in the end, the reason why we are doing all of these things is to make working people better off and to put more money in their pockets. Thank you very much.